Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 29, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion on the call today are those of the experts. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Special programming note, today's call is going to be 45 minutes, maximum of 45 minutes rather than 60 minutes, but we're very pleased to welcome as our guest host, Virginia Sloan. She's the president of the Constitution Project right here in Washington, D.C., and she's helping us with this call, helping us procure the speaker, and is going to introduce the speaker as well, after which we'll hear from our speaker for opening remarks of about 15 to 20 minutes, but as always, we'll be looking to you for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions. With that, Virginia Sloan, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Dean, and thank you for including me in this important conversation. I'm delighted, as always, to work with the Federalist Society. The Constitution Project has a long history of doing that, and I'm delighted to be introducing my friend, my longtime friend, Vinita Gupta, who is the head of the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department. It's a position that Vinita is particularly well suited to serve as because of her long history of working for civil rights and for justice. And she is, I think, particularly suited to working with the Federalist Society and others around the country who share a diversity of views. Her work focuses on criminal justice issues and policing issues, promoting disability rights, protecting the rights of LGBTI individuals, also discrimination in education, housing, lending, and voting. She has a long career in various organizations working on those and other issues. But because of the work that the Constitution Project does in bringing together people with a diversity of views on the right and the left and everywhere else, we're pleased to work not only with the Federalist Society, with Vinita as well, because of her ability to reach out to and work with people of differing views. When Vinita was named to this post, Grover Norquist, who I'm sure many on this call know as president of Americans for Tax Reform, said that she's, and I quote here, good to work with and a serious person. She's been open to working with conservatives on good policy. She's played a strong role in the left-right cooperation in criminal justice issues. And today, especially when we see the right and the left coming together on criminal justice and other related issues and making real progress, Vinita has been helping to lead that effort, and we've obtained some substantial successes. David Keene, who was president of the NRA and also the head of the American Conservative Union, has, like Grover Norquist, has praised Vinita's work and what he describes as her collaborative approach. And again, I'll quote from what he had to say. Vinita is a very good person. I've worked with her on criminal justice reform issues. Most of the Obama administration people have been so ideologically driven that they won't talk to people who disagree with them. Vinita is someone who works with everyone. She both listens to and works with people from all perspectives to accomplish real good. And I think that's exactly the description of Vinita, and I hope that in her remarks today that's going to come through loud and clear, and that I know she will be open to hearing your questions and your comments, and I'm just very pleased to be asked to introduce someone who's as skilled and dedicated and open as Vinita Gupta.
Thank you so much, Jenny, for your kind words. I really, truly appreciate it. I appreciate your bipartisan leadership on criminal justice reform and a host of so many other important issues. So good afternoon. I want to thank the Federalist Society for hosting today's call and Dean Reuter for inviting me to be on. And I want to thank everyone who's listening for joining the call. It really is a pleasure to join all of you. So I have only been at the helm of the Civil Rights Division for about 1 year. And I can just say, and it won't be news to anyone on this call, that it's been a rather intense and active year for the division, partly driven by tragedies around the country, partly driven by increased community awareness on these issues. The conversations certainly around policing and criminal justice reform have really been placed at the center of our national debate. I think that for those of us who have been engaged in these issues for many years and have been doing the right-left work to advance criminal justice reform, the ability to see where we are today on these issues versus where we were 5 years ago, when often very few on the right or the left were actually paying attention to what was happening in our criminal justice system, to the ineffectiveness, to the waste, to the overreaching. I think to see where we are today has been very heartening, and I know that the Federalist Society has played an important role in that as well. I would just like to take some minutes right now to discuss our work at the Civil Rights Division to reform our criminal justice system, including our efforts to address mistrust between law enforcement and the communities they serve, an issue which has made a lot of headlines in the past year and continues to even to this day. Before I do, though, I'd just like to start with a short story that explains a little bit the perspective that I bring to these issues. As a law student, I saw a broken criminal justice system fairly early on that was entrenched with a lot of different problems, and I really felt compelled to do something about it. Just a few months after graduation, I joined a prominent civil rights organization, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and weeks in, I found myself in a small town called Tulia, Texas, looking into a rather troubling series of cases. I had heard about a drug sting that had culminated in the arrest on a single day. It was July 23, 1999, of 46 individuals, 40 of whom were African American and 6 were white or Latino individuals who had romantic relationships with African Americans. And that morning, 12% of the town's African American population was jailed on the very low-level drug charges. A local newspaper ran the headline, "Tulia Streets Cleared of Garbage," and printed the names and addresses of all of the individuals who had been arrested and hauled to jail by SWAT teams that had raided people's homes. And despite very little legal experience to speak of at the time, I just couldn't ignore those simple facts. And so I got on a plane and started to investigate. And what I found in Tulia was deeply disturbing. It was an entire community that had been torn apart based on the word of a single officer who had, it turned out, himself been investigated for misconduct and use of racially derogatory terminology during the so-called sting operation. And his uncorroborated testimony had sent dozens of men and women to prison for sentences ranging from 20 to 40 to 60 to, in one case, 361 years on charges that they had sold very small amounts of cocaine. And it took 2 very long years to bring justice to our clients, but by 2003, we had shown that the so-called victory in the war on drugs had, in fact, been a grave injustice. And as a result of our work, Governor Rick Perry pardoned the Tulia defendants, and after 4 long years after the ordeal had begun, they were finally free. Now, Tulia is one community, and I will say at the time, this victory, while it was very great for the community in Tulia itself and for the families, felt like a drop in the bucket, because at the time, the trajectory on incarceration around the country, and particularly in Texas, was on the way up and up, and huge amounts of the state budgets around the country were being invested in funding a growing criminal justice system. At that point, we had 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. And so it was a lesson that a few years later, when Texas actually started to be one of the pioneering states enacting criminal justice reform and really showing to the country how a state could both reduce incarceration while continuing to see historic reductions in crime, was really, I think, a very powerful thing, but it was not something that was in existence when I was deeply engaged in TULIA, but it did happen several years later, and Texas truly was one of the pioneering states in that regard. So while I am relatively new, and so let me just take one step, that experience obviously shaped a lot of my thinking about the work that was needed in our criminal justice system, and I had worked very closely both with elected officials in Texas. Obviously, the governor's office had a very big role to play in the ultimate remedy, but it was a lesson to me in the power that can come from having conversations with people who you may think don't agree, but actually see very much eye to eye on some key issues. And it's something that has influenced the way that I approach the work that I do and has done throughout my career. While I am relatively new to this enforcement role at the Civil Rights Division, as someone who's spent her whole adult life on criminal justice reform and engaged with stakeholders from a whole range of viewpoints and perspectives, as I said, you know, 10 or even 5 years ago, there were just too few people who were concerned about these issues. And I was at the American Civil Liberties Union about 5 or 6 years ago when I started to reach out to some key folks like other progressive organizations and other conservative organizations like Right on Crime, which was beginning to come under formation with Mark Levin and others who've done really tremendous work on this front. I reached out to the American Legislative Exchange Council and was doing work with them and later with the Koch Institute, as well as with civil rights groups that frankly had not taken on the issue of criminal justice reform throughout several decades. I think too few at that point really imagined that we could bridge political differences and work across the aisle to build consensus around the strategies and solutions that we needed to employ. But I will say today there really truly is bipartisan reform efforts around the country. I think the states have been leading the way. And have been real models for the work that's happening nationwide now and finally at the federal level. And I think that this is why I feel today optimistic that the country is on the cusp of really seizing the promising moment to achieve real and sustainable reform. Both former Attorney General Holder and now Attorney General Lynch, our nation's top law enforcement leaders, have committed the Justice Department to ending our over-reliance on incarceration, to being smart on crime, and to keeping our kids in school rather than in the courts and in jail, a prospect that has both been very harmful to communities, but also has been incredibly expensive and has not yielded the kind of dividends that we would want. I would like to just highlight some of the work that we're doing here at the division across a range of areas of criminal justice areas, from policing to bail reform, to juvenile justice and solitary confinement that contribute right now to the ongoing effort. Through our criminal work, our criminal justice work, the division is committed to leading fair investigations. And that includes, of course, holding police officers accountable for misconduct. We have a criminal section in the Civil Rights Division that both does hate crime prosecutions and human trafficking work, but also does hold public corrections and police officers accountable for misconduct, but we also close investigations when the evidence just doesn't support the charges, even in the face sometimes of vocal outcries for the prosecution. It's something that I'm really proud of. The integrity of the career lawyers at the Civil Rights Division is incredibly high, and I will say that I think, a most recent example of that was with our criminal investigation of Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, for example, where we found, after extensive investigation, that the evidence simply did not support civil rights charges or against him. And in that matter, a team of some of the division's most experienced civil rights prosecutors and agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation conducted the investigation. They reviewed physical and forensic evidence. They considered all written reports in an independent autopsy. They interviewed more than 100 people, including purported eyewitnesses. They canvassed more than 300 residences. And they produced, finally, what was just under a 100-page report laying out everything that they had examined and looked at that led to the conclusion that Officer Darren Wilson, that there were no grounds for a federal prosecution. And as career employees who were conducting those investigations with the highest degree of professionalism, I think, really demonstrated the legitimacy that comes with an office that is willing to seek the fact, the truth, wherever the law and the facts may lead them. And that's been incredibly important by way of building trust with the between the division and law enforcement as well. At so many stages in the criminal justice process, as many of you know, both from encounters with officers on the street to treatment by judges in the courts, we also find low-income people and people of color, worse off than others, they are disproportionately arrested, jailed, and subjected often to excessive and unconstitutional fines and fees. And as a consequence, they can often find themselves trapped in a cycle of collateral consequences, from the automatic loss of a driver's license to the inability to find a job, lending people to sometimes have an easier path to return to crime than one would ever want or want from good public policy. In the report that we issued examining the Ferguson Police Department, which is the second report that we did on Ferguson, we found a powerful dynamic at work, and it was really the city's undue focus on generating revenue through policing, what I can now consider kind of an unconstitutional tax on the poor. We uncovered emails explicitly stating that enforcement strategies had been undertaken to, quote, fill the revenue pipeline. Officers were instructed to take ticketing, quote, to the next level or risk disciplinary action. The amount that was collected in fines and fees exploded, nearly tripling from almost $1.4 million in 2010 to a projected almost $3.1 million in 2015. There were 50% more tickets issued in 2014 than in 2010, even though Ferguson's population did not change, and even minor code violations sometimes resulted in multiple arrests, jail time, and payments that far exceeded the cost of the original ticket many times over. Here's a prime example. In 2007, one woman received two parking tickets that together totaled $152. And as of March, she had paid $550 in fines and fees to the city of Ferguson. She had been arrested twice for having unpaid tickets and had spent 6 days in jail, and yet she still inexplicably owed Ferguson $541. Now, based on work around the country, we know that there are similar police and court practices in many places. And in the months subsequent to the issuance of our report, we know that other cities and jurisdictions have begun to reexamine their policing and municipal court practices, though we know that there is much more work to do. I think it's simply unacceptable and, in fact, unconstitutional that thousands of people are penalized merely because they're poor. They fill the jails. A lot of sheriffs are deeply frustrated by this, that it's not truly about public safety, but about revenue generation. And as a result, before Ferguson and since, we've taken on other practices that unfairly disadvantage low-income individuals. And it's kind of, and some of this work created right-left coalitions as well. In August, for example, we argued in an Idaho case that punishing homeless people for camping or sleeping in public when there's insufficient shelter space in the city criminalizes people for their status of being homeless in violation of the Eighth Amendment. And in an Alabama case this year, we argued that a system of prefixed bail amounts that imprison people without regard to their ability to pay violates the 14th Amendment. We've also drawn attention to the failure to provide indigent defendants counsel in criminal cases. This has also been a right-left issue. In several states, we've taken the position in court filings that indigent defendants are denied their Sixth Amendment right to counsel when their public defenders are so overworked and under-resourced that they serve as counsel in name only. It's worth talking a little bit about a couple of these cases. In July, we released the findings of our investigation into St. Louis County's juvenile justice system, and we found that chronic underfunding of the indigent defense system and significant delays in the appointment of attorneys had resulted in the deprivation of counsel writ large. The county family court had just a single public defender and 400 new cases in 2014, and only 3 cases out of 280 were completed by the public defender's office that year actually went to trial. The vast majority of the rest resulted in guilty pleas, and not a single appeal was filed in 2014. And we've been committed in having very good conversations, productive conversations with St. Louis County to bring about some reform, much needed reform. Our involvement in a Georgia case is another example. There, a class of defendants in Cordell Circuit challenged the frequent absence of lawyers in juvenile court, the meet-em and plead-em processing of adults in superior court, and the utter inability of the circuit's 3 public defenders to provide adequate representation in their 1,400 cases. One of the named plaintiffs was a 16-year-old boy who was charged with stealing Halloween fangs worth just under $3 from Walmart. The suit alleged that when he appeared in court, there was no public defender to assist him, but the judge allowed him to admit to the crime anyway, and he was sentenced to 9 months of probation, 40 hours of community service and restitution, plus $50 in court fees. We filed a brief asserting the Sixth Amendment rights of defendants and the special protections that must be provided to children. And less than 6 weeks later, the party settled the case consistent with the principles that we articulated, includes enhanced resources for lawyers and protections against the uninformed waiver of counsel. The bottom line is, of course, that no one should be arrested, jailed, or denied a fair defense because they are poor. I think we can't expect for people to have confidence in our justice system until we build a system that provides basic fairness, meets constitutional standards, and provides access to justice for all, and that is efficient for the jurisdictions that are operating it. And the bottom line is that, when our criminal justice system has disproportionate impacts on young people and low-income folks, it falls short of achieving its fundamental purpose, which is the protection of public safety. As part of the broader conversation that's also taking place right now about the fairness of our criminal justice system, we have seen a growing and widespread right-left concern about conditions in our prisons and jails, including, in particular, the use of solitary confinement. Under the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act, or CRIPA, the division has the authority to investigate jails and prisons to determine whether they are engaged in any patterns or practices of violating the rights of prisoners. If we find a pattern or practice, we try to negotiate a reform program and offer technical assistance. In the less likely in scenarios where those efforts fail, we can sue. But our CRIPA-related work on solitary confinement goes back to 1993, when the division obtained remedies to correct the overly restrictive and anti-therapeutic 23-hour-per-day lockdown of adult prisoners with mental illness at the Montana State Prison. And more recently, we have focused on the particular harm that solitary confinement can cause for vulnerable populations, such as prisoners with serious mental illness and juvenile detainees. Even before I came to the division, there was a lot of conversation with groups like Right on Crime, as well as faith groups, about their concerns around excessive use of solitary confinement. And I think that there is even more activity around the country on these issues right now. Some of the most thoughtful, visionary, and courageous leaders on reforming solitary confinement practices are state corrections officials, people who know day in and day out the very real challenges of jail and prison management. And while the Department of Justice has an important role to play, we all know that real and lasting change on this issue and so many others really has to take place at the local level. And I'm going to get back to that in 1 minute. Outside of the Civil Rights Division, the Department of Justice is also committed to addressing mass incarceration and reforming our criminal justice system. In 2013, under the leadership of former Attorney General Holder, the department launched a Smart on Crime initiative that year, and the effort focuses on ensuring that federal laws are fairly enforced and more efficiently enforced by targeting the most serious crimes and prosecuting the most dangerous criminals. A key component to this work is sentencing reform, and specifically reforming our charging policies so that people who've committed low-level nonviolent drug offenses don't face draconian mandatory minimum sentences. Just last week, and in fact, I just saw today, the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, just last week she testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee in support of the Bipartisan Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. And in that testimony, she cited evidence that was demonstrating that the Department's Smart on Crime initiative is working. There had been some criticism of it. Critics had voiced the concern that curtailing mandatory minimums would limit the number of defendants who plead guilty, which is a critical tool to leverage cooperation and reach the higher levels of drug organizations. But the facts, she said, show that even as our use of mandatory minimums has decreased by about 25%, defendants are still pleading guilty and cooperating at exactly the same rate. And in speaking about our criminal justice reform, I think we also have to evaluate the broader systemic causes that factor in, because in many ways, the unrest that exploded this past year in Ferguson and Baltimore and other cities across America also highlighted underlying problems of inadequate schools, jobs, issues, transportation, and the like, problems that have been built over decades. And I think that that is also a part of the current conversation that we're having. I will say that I have spent much of the last year doing work with law enforcement and in communities that have been particularly distressed around relations with law enforcement. Even before I came into the Justice Department, I had done outreach with some of the key associations, law enforcement associations, reaching out to major city chiefs, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the Fraternal Order of Police, the National Association of Police Officers, and several more, in part because, to me, we're not really going to get through these challenges if we aren't taking a collaborative approach. There's been a lot of us versus them on both sides. There's been a lot of mutual mistrust and lobbying of accusations, and I think that one of the things that I've realized, I just spoke recently, just 2 days ago, before several thousand law enforcement leaders at the International Association of Chiefs of Police. It was the first time that the Civil Rights Division had addressed the General Assembly there, and I spoke alongside two police chiefs as well as a civil rights leader, and had a really candid and thorough conversation about some of the issues that we're seeing take place today. I think that we have to understand the depth of the challenges and the magnitude of the task that's facing our police officers. And I say this everywhere I go. I say it to all audiences. I think the truth is that we are asking more from our police officers than anyone can reasonably expect. Every day they're encountering people in crisis. They're encountering mental illness, alcohol and drug addiction, and school discipline issues. And in many ways, we've thrown the criminal justice system at a whole host of social problems, and too often given law enforcement only one set of tools to address them, arrest and incarceration, and too often have not provided them with the resources to do their job in these kinds of conditions. They are often, we find when we go into a jurisdiction, outdated equipment that puts them at risk and puts their lives more kind of undermined officer safety issues. We found that there are often or too often no ways to address officer wellness and mental health and stress issues given how incredibly stressful their jobs are. And we often find that line officers will tell us that they have welcomed the intervention of the Justice Department to be able to provide the political will to give them the kind of resources that they need to do their jobs more safely and better, and that is, I think, officer wellness and safety are key components of community policing. And so as we continue to really shape this important conversation around criminal justice reform, I don't think that we can afford to pretend at all that any single reform or policy or intervention on its own is going to repair the system. But there's a lot of right now real opportunity to build trust in jurisdictions around the country. And I will say that, which is, I sometimes get asked, well, is the Justice Department taking over police departments, or are we trying to federalize law enforcement? And the answer is absolutely not. Policing is at its core a local function. There are a lot of things that the Justice Department does by way of grants programs through the Office of Justice Programs and the COPS program to provide grants and funding, but also technical assistance where it's been requested, and training around the country to police departments all over the country. Certainly when the Civil Rights Division comes in to address to investigate where there's been a real concern about unconstitutional policing, the work is very grounded in what we are doing locally. There is no cookie cutter approach to our policing work. Every place we work looks different. There are different demographics, different dynamics. We spend a lot of time engaging with law enforcement leaders, with line officers, with police unions, with civil rights leaders, business leaders, civic leaders, faith leaders, both not only, I think, to understand the problem of what is happening and what has led to an erosion of trust between law enforcement and the communities that they serve, but also, and I think importantly, in devising remedies where we have found unconstitutional patterns and practices. We draw heavily from the input that we get from law enforcement leaders, from line officers, from community folks in devising the remedies that are suitable to the local situation and the local jurisdiction. And that is why every agreement we have looks very different. And that is why every agreement we have has also sought to build local structures that are peopled and populated by local leaders, both from the law enforcement and other parts of the community, to achieve sustainable reform so that the Department of Justice is not in the jurisdiction a day longer than we need to be, and where we can see sustainable reform that has taken root because local leaders from every part of the community have a stake in their local criminal justice system and in their local police practices and police department. And I think that the relationships that get developed that really come from being able to see each other eye to eye, to dehumanize each other, to break down the us versus them, while it sounds trite, is incredibly powerful and is what we seek to achieve. And I've really benefited this year from a lot of guidance and input from law enforcement folks in how we're thinking about these issues and thinking about this work. So I've spoken a lot. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to speak with you today. I think the complex issues are not going to be solved overnight. But when I look at the monumental shift in the public discourse around these issues, I know that we're making progress. And I know that we don't always need to agree on every idea in order to work together and build consensus. But I do think the opportunity to change the paradigm on over-incarceration is now, and how we're going to tackle this work in the months and years ahead is really going to depend on our ability to collaborate with one another and to be able to find common sense solutions as we move forward. So with that, I will be open to responding to some questions.
Well, thank you so much. This is Dean Reuter again. As we open the floor to questions, let me mention that our guest won't be able to respond to questions that concern ongoing matters, of course. And as I mentioned at the outset, this call is budgeted for 45 minutes, so we've got about 12 minutes left for questions. I'd ask our callers to be as concise as possible with their questions. Having said that, in a moment we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. When you hear that announcement, if you have a question, just push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. So once again, if you have a question for our guest, our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller of the day.
Hi, I wonder if you had any thoughts on sanctuary cities.
That is actually outside of my lane at the Civil Rights Division, so I don't have any thoughts that I would be able to share on this call.
Very good. We've still got two questions pending. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. Do you know of any specific legislation that's trying to fund public defender's offices further to equip them to be able to handle the mass incarceration issue?
Yeah, there are a number of states that are, have been looking at these issues. I don't have them offhand right now, but I know that states like Texas enacted some significant public defender reform a couple of years ago, and there are states right now that have been looking at this issue. In fact, three organizations that are doing significant work on this are the NACDL, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the Koch Institute has put in a lot of funding on these issues, as well as as well as the American Civil Liberties Union, my former place of employment. At the Justice Department, we have a component that is focused on these issues, on access to justice issues, and has been, and I can certainly, if you have an interest, put you in touch with our access to justice folks to get the very specific, to get a specific rundown of the states.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks.
Dean, I don't know if you're able to connect me up after this call. I'm happy to do that.
I can jot down a phone number here and do that. I'm wondering, this is Dean, is 100% of the funding for public defenders, does it originate in the state, or is there any federal money for that?
There is federal money for it. It's a smaller pool in most, but the federal, the Justice Department, in fact, funds and helps to support indigent defense systems around the country, as well as trainings and the like, and that's out of our Bureau of Justice Assistance. But by and large, states are funding this. In some places, though, counties are bearing the cost, and there has been litigation that counties have brought against states to try to get them to fund the mandate to provide public defense systems. So there's a variety of different ways that this is playing out in states, but there is federal support for some systems around the country.
If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you're in our audience. We have just one question pending. Before we go to the next caller, let me ask you a follow-up question on this issue, if I could. This is Dean. Does any of the civil asset forfeiture money, that's one of the issues that we've been talking about here at the Federalist Society. We've had telephone calls on this before, some of the controversies around civil asset forfeiture. Does any of that seized money end up in the public defender FISC, or do you know?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think so, but I don't want to say definitively.
Sure. Okay. Once again, we're speaking with Vinita Gupta. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now take another call.
Hi, this is Chris Green from Ole Miss Law School. I'm curious what you think the prospects might be for a general reform of prosecutorial discretion, particularly Bill Stuntz had some proposals that he made that prosecutors be required to show that they enforce the law systematically. I mean, this could be adopted by the federal government on its own, or local governments on their own, or the federal government kind of encouraging local governments to do that. Is that the kind of general thing that you see any interest in?
Well, I think that, when former Attorney General Holder issued his 2013 memo to federal prosecutors instructing them to exercise their discretion away from mandatory minimum charging in certain categories of nonviolent low-level offenses, that was an effort to curb prosecutorial discretion away from what would result in long sentences. And that move has been kind of institutionalized here at the division in the Smart on Crime initiative, and it's something that both this Attorney General and this Deputy Attorney General are very committed to continuing. And so there's been a lot of active conversation at the federal level about the issue of prosecutorial discretion, and so that's a very active conversation. I think that right now in states around the country, there's a lot of different conversations with different district attorney associations and the like on this issue, but I can't speak specifically to what the states are doing in that, but I do know at the federal level there is a very active and engaged conversation about how can we both protect public safety and ensure that we're getting, the violent criminals who should not be on the streets while exercising discretion away from some of the harsh results in sentencing that have been a feature of the federal system for a very long time.
Thanks.
The lines are wide open now. If you have a question, this is the time to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we've got another question, so I will defer to our next audience member.
Hi, this is Bill Maurer from the Institute for Justice. Thank you for all the hard work you're doing in this very difficult area. My question concerns your discussion regarding Ferguson. and noting that the municipal government in Ferguson was sort of using the police force as a means to raise revenue. That is a pretty substantial issue along all of St. Louis County, and is probably, I would say, a significant issue in other municipalities in the United States, and becoming more so as time goes on. Is there any concerted or directed attempt by the Justice Department to address the idea that municipalities shouldn't be policing for profit or using their enforcement powers as a substitute for taxation?
Yeah, thank you. And I had worked with the Institute for Justice a fair bit in my prior life before entering the Justice Department, so I'm glad you're on the call. You know, it is a widespread issue, and it's not just the St. Louis region. It's, since we issued our report, it's come to our attention just how pervasive this problem is around the country. And it is something that the Justice Department is looking at quite a lot right now at other jurisdictions. I will say there's also been, happily, local and state leadership in certain states at looking at their practices. Missouri right now has an effort underway to examine their state practices in this regard, but there are other states as well that are. We are right now kind of taking a look at what we might be able to do by way of being able to help provide some guidance to jurisdictions about how to ensure that they aren't engaging kind of this unconstitutional tax, so to speak, or abusive fees and fines practices. And so that is something that we're talking about. We're also obviously, we have the enforcement arm. We would prefer to be able to be able to provide proactive guidance as well. I think it's a real trick, though, because to the extent that jurisdictions have become reliant on this source of revenue, being able to shift that, which would have also an enormous impact on courts and policing and trust between the local justice system and the community, I think is really key. But we need to be able to address some of those questions that are real kind of issues for local elected officials. And so we're having a lot of different conversations right now. We welcome your thoughts in this work, and we may be having some meetings coming up on this issue. And if it's something that the Institute for Justice is interested in, I would love to have your participation. We're right now thinking of a meeting in early December at some point, but it would be great to think about having your voice at the table.
Oh, absolutely.
We do have another question. We do have another question. We've got a couple of minutes, so let's see if we can take a final question here.
Yeah, I was just wondering, is there kind of a general consensus at the level of the institutes that you're working on that, because, the federal initiative of the war on drugs has arguably, caused a lot of the civil rights issues of keeping, poor and racial profiling going on. Is there kind of a wide range recognition that that is a direct link, or is that kind of being washed over?
I would say there is a recognition of that. I think that's why the leadership of the Department of Justice has not shied away in recognizing that, and I think that's why there is an onus on us to actually do something about it. And so it's not, and that's where I will repeat what I said, which is that in many ways the state took the lead on this and are continuing to lead, but I think that there really is a lot of momentum right now at the federal level, both under cognizant of the role that some of the federal practices and policies have played in really building this up, but also in recognizing the importance of looking around and seeing what states have been doing and finding solutions. And I think, the reality, though, is look, at the Justice Department, that's one way. There are things that we are seeking to do, that the Deputy Attorney General is seeking to do through the Smart on Crime Initiative. But obviously, there really is a need for Congress to act, and that is why the Justice Department has been supporting bipartisan reform legislation. And we'll see what happens, but the hope is that there will be, that Congress will act on these issues.
Great, thanks.
Well, I mentioned at the outset that we have but 45 minutes for today's call, and Vanita Gupta, you've been very generous with your time. We're out of our budgeted time. Let me give you 60 seconds if you'd like to take it to express a final thought, though.
Sure. I just want to thank folks for joining the call and for giving me a chance to speak with all of you. I do think that this is an incredible opportunity to focus on kind of common sense solutions to some longstanding problems. And I hope that any and all of you will seek out engagement with the Civil Rights Division as you think would be useful. I'm available to talk about these issues, as are the staff, but these are top priority issues at the division and for the department. And I just want to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to speak with you.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, and special thanks to Virginia Sloan and the Constitution Project for their help in this. It's always good to collaborate with them. To our audience, a reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be hosting author Tara Smith and Professor Gary Lawson. They'll be talking about Ms. Smith's new book, Judicial Review in an Objective Legal System. But until that next call tomorrow at 2, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.